The narrow, winding road from Mari Velas was choked with traffic and veiled in thick clouds of dust and fumes. As the Americans and Filipinos marched north to prison camp, the Japanese troops marched south to take up positions for the coming amphibious assault on Corregidor. A steady stream of artillery pieces, ammunition, and supplies pressed south, reminding the prisoners that they were, in effect, refugees left in a most infelicitous position, caught in the teeth of an ongoing war. Convoys of tanks and troop-carrying vehicles pushed through the crowds. Many of the Japanese soldiers smiled and waved at the Americans as they passed by in their trucks, while a few, taking advantage of the anonymity of the situation, would reach down and bash unsuspecting prisoners over the head with bamboo sticks, or sneak in a quick blow with their rifle butts. "We couldn't predict what they'd do," Abraham said. "Some of them wished us well, and some of them just wanted revenge." As they marched through the barrios of Kabkaban, Lamao, and Limay, the deepening chaos grew more combustible by the hour. Military order was deteriorating fast. The official commands and injunctions, whatever they may have been, were not effectively trickling down to the foot soldiers. Vengeance spread over the road like a fever. Coming face to face with the enemy they'd battled for nearly 4 months, the Japanese burned with the natural contempt of the victor. They had reason to hate the Americans for holding out so long, since Tokyo had expected Bataan to fall months earlier. And they had reason to hate the Americans for giving up so soon, since according to the Bushido Code, surrender was beneath the dignity of a true soldier. With the clusters of prisoners now isolated from each other and spread out for miles, each guard realized that he could do whatever he wanted, that he was, in this temporary context, omnipotent. Abraham thought this was the case with the Japanese soldier who was guarding his group as they stood at attention beside the artesian spring. The guard, he felt, was intoxicated by his new power. Abraham could not conceive of any other explanation for how a person could be so cruel. The men were dying of thirst, and water was right there. It was plentiful and free, and it would not take much time for the men to get a drink. Yet the guard made the prisoners stand there and listen to the soft babble. Finally, one of the men in Abraham's group could take it no longer. He bolted from the ranks and threw himself upon the spring. With relish, he splashed the water on his face, slurping and lapping it up. Then the guard materialized, swaggering over like a goose, as Abraham put it. He shouted something in Japanese, and the American, coming to his senses, pulled away from the stream. Abraham watched in dull disbelief as the guard unsheathed his sword. With a quick, ugly swish, he brought the blade down and cleanly decapitated the American. The head plunked into the spring and sank in a thin roil of blood. The body lingered for a moment, suspended in an upright posture, and then it too toppled over into the spring, with the arms dancing in the water current. Abraham noticed that the man's hands nervously opened and closed, like the pincers of a crab.